Hello, everybody. Welcome to another Bald Move Prestige film. This time we're talking about The Master, which, if all goes right, we'll be releasing this around at or around September the 14th, which is its 10th anniversary of wide release. This movie is directed by Paul Thomas Anderson, written by PTA as well. It stars Joaquin Phoenix, Philip Seymour Hoffman, Amy Adams. Of course, I guess I should be talking about Joaquin Phoenix. He's Commodus. He's Swing Away Meryl in the Happening, whatever.
Cash. Signs.
Yeah, sure. All those things. Felix Seymour Hoffman. I mean, come on. He's the it's now a moon. It's a space station. Tornado guy from Twister. He's the dilettante in Finding Mr. Ridley. What the hell has happened to my brain? Jesus.
Mr. Holland's Open. That's not the one.
He's Boogie Nights. Sure. The Talented Mr. Ripley. Capote. He's been in a lot of cool shit. Gone too soon. Amy Adams. My personal, I think, favorite star in Hollywood right now. Been in The Arrival, American Hustle, tons of great shit. Laura Dern, Jurassic Park's own. Rami Malek, Mr. Robot, hello. Jesse Plemons, Meth Damon, are you kidding me? All the Bald Move favorites in this here movie that left a lot of people confused and conflicted. This came out right before we started doing Bald Movies. I know you and I both saw it and we really, really liked it. But boy, critical opinion is all over the place. So Roger Ebert damned this film with what I'd call faint praise at 2.5 stars, calling it beautiful, well-acted, ultimately meaningless. One of his last reviews, like in April of the next year, he's going to die. So it's like, man, that was a really coming up on the 10-year anniversary of Mr. Ebert's death. Jim, what'd you think of this movie? Both first, have you seen it since? And what'd you think when we watched it here for a Prestige podcast?
So this is only the second time I've seen this movie. The first time, you know, saw it in theaters with you. And I remember walking out of this movie going, wow, that really blew me away. And the performances are just incredible. And I think that part of the movie holds true. I think it's undeniably amazing performances from pretty much everybody across the board, but Joaquin Phoenix and Philip Seymour Hoffman in particular just blow me away.
Scorching.
And I remember the first time I saw this movie coming away from it thinking, boy, they really put Scientology and L. Ron Hubbard in particular on blast. And I was surprised, actually, when I went and rewatched this movie that they never once mention L. Ron Hubbard by name. They never once mentioned Scientology by name, because coming out of this the first time, I thought this was literally about Scientology. I didn't think there was any obfuscation with the names have been changed and you know, no, whatever disclaimer they put at the beginning of movies like that, right? Or at the end. It turns out this is like, obviously it is a riff on Scientology and L. Ron Hubbard. Yeah. There's no denying that.
Yeah.
Although, you know, the movie studios and Ben PTA would deny it up and down because they'll get their asses sued if they don't. But it apparently the movie is not about L. Ron Hubbard exactly, which blew my mind. And the second time around, I feel very much more up in the air about this because I'm looking at it, you know, expecting these great performances. And so when they come, they still blow me away, but they don't shade my opinion of the entire movie as much. And I'm looking for, and maybe I'm just a more sophisticated movie viewer at this point. It's 10 years on. We've been covering movies since then. And I'm looking for the meaning in this movie. And I'm finding meaning in places, right? I'm finding meaning in final speeches from characters. I'm finding meaning in the visual storytelling, but I'm not really able to grab onto any one thing and say, this is what the movie's about. And that is a hard thing to come away from a movie with and still feel like it's an amazing movie.
Hmm.
Because most of the time when I come away with questions, it's questions about how I feel about the message of the movie, not what the hell was the message of this movie.
Yeah.
I really liked this movie when I first saw it. I immediately, you know, like cults kind of have kinship with other cults. You know, we've famously kind of grew up in a fundamentalist religions cult. That has like it's different kooky than Scientologists, but it has a lot of the same kookiness, you know. And I immediately got like I really liked the way that they showed that this guy, you know, was vulnerable to the cult, the way it works on the people with this kind of system of love bombing and catastrophizing. So you just really have these intense relationships with people. And then ultimately, I thought it was really satisfying is this guy, even though he's a broken person, is able to, through some effort of will, resist committing. And you know, I don't know if he ends up saving his life, but certainly he dodged a bullet by the end of this movie. And like you said, I just think the performances, like the just so the intensity of some of the stuff that goes on between, in particular, Seymour Hoffman and Joaquin Phoenix here is just it's just so wild and bizarre. And their relationship, their attraction, the things that bind them together feels very similar, simultaneously rock solid, but also inexplicable. You know, like why the fascination with this guy? Why does he entrust him with these abilities? Why is this happening? The interior of like the cult, you know, like the way that like there's new light and people's reaction to that and the founders. Like I think this is all just really fascinating stuff. And I still feel that way. Like, what is the point of the movie? I don't know. I think it's just really intense study of like cults of personality and how they operate. It felt everything felt very, very realistic. And it's like, that's the thing. It's like, maybe it's not Scientology, but it's like 95% of Scientology. And this guy is not L. Ron Hubbard. But he's 95% of L. Ron Hubbard. There's a couple scenes where Joaquin Phoenix is taking pictures of Philip Seymour Hoffman in exactly the same outfits that like you'll recognize if you've ever cracked Dianetics or Battlefield Earth or Mission Earth or any of his crazy shit. Like he's on the back of that wearing like this weird Admiral's uniform with a feathered quill with his hand on his chin, looking like a douchebag intellectual, styles himself as a doctor and a nuclear physicist and all this other fabulous shit. But they show like the how like the charisma and as like this curious blend of charisma and fragility. And like, I also thought it's fascinating to be like, how much of this shit did he really buy? Did he start knowing that this was a fraud and just was so in love with his own voice and had so many people under his spell that he starts believing it himself? And then when he has moments of doubt or moments of like fraud complex that he later overcomes, or those like interpreted as weaknesses of faith that were later, I don't know. And I think that's like the really another really interesting lens to like, not just, I think a lot of people look at it as like, you know, what's happening to Joaquin Phoenix, but what's happening with Philip Seymour Hoffman's character of Lancaster Dodd.
Yeah. And even the two of them together. Right. But the thing that makes it so confounding to me is that the moments of insight come so infrequently in this movie. I think.
Do they really?
Yeah. I think so. They spend a lot of time painting a picture of these two guys and not a lot of time like giving you insight into what that picture is saying about them. And the movie comes off as like, you know, not one-sided either. It doesn't have a strong opinion, I feel, on this person, either of these people. Like, I don't know by the end of the movie that Joaquin Phoenix has changed. I don't know by the end of the movie that I understand whether Lancaster Dodd is a flim-flam artist or simply a man who believes a thing strongly and is very compelling when he speaks about it. I can't quite pin either of these characters down, and that makes it both interesting but also very confounding.
I guess I can see that. I think this film is gorgeous. It was shot 65mm. It was widely distributed in 70mm. which is like, if you ever get a chance to see a 70 millimeter on an IMAX or something, I encourage you to do so. It looked great in the 4K transfer that I watched. There's just shots that are so beautiful. The aquamarine of a large ship at seas, the propellers cutting through the deep blue of the sea, the muted tones of the salt flats, and watching a figure disappear into the heat disturbance of it. Just like some of the close-ups of just like the intensity of Philip Seymour Hoffman and Joaquin Phoenix and their struggle sessions. And the soundtrack, my God, Johnny Greenwood, who you might recognize as a member of Radiohead, and turns out has done a lot of soundtracks. There Will Be Blood, The Master, Inherent Vice, Phantom Thread, among others. This is just a real masterpiece. Like, there is discordant music that plays when things are creepy. There's dreamy music when you can't tell if things are like real or a fantasy. There's soaring aspirational music when the Scientology is starting to work, or maybe not working, or you're hoping it's working. Like, there's a lot of like really interesting sonic texture, because there's not like stuff you can hum or tap your toe. It's all atmospheric, and it's exactly what this movie needs, and it suits the visuals and the acting style perfectly.
And I think there's a risk here, you know, with a movie about Scientology and L. Ron Hubbard and seeing all of these processing methods, right? That you could tip over into satire or into blatant criticism of the thing you're covering. And I don't think the movie ever does, which is surprising to me.
This is
kind of what I was looking for. And coming out of this, you know, the first time thinking, oh, they really put Scientology on blast, I kind of expected to see more of that the second time around, but it's not there really.
I kind of like that. The fact that like the movie does not condemn the cause.
Right.
I think the movie does. But the movie itself maintains a completely neutral POV. It's just watching rituals. It's watching interactions between people. It's not saying whether things are good and bad. It's not going to put the thumb on the scale about whether this is completely nonsense or meaningless. It has a couple of exchanges where the fictional version of L. Ron Hubbard is able to defend his movement from pretty pointed criticism. And like I said, well, that's what I'm saying, but I feel like if you're keeping score of the balls going across the net, he commits a lot more fouls and a lot more points come past him than his opposition. And I think that's where it's like, the movie's not condemning, but like, you know, you have to go pretty far outside what I think is a reasonable position to think that this is all net good, you know?
Absolutely.
Apparently, it really pissed off Tom Cruise when his good friend Paul Thomas Anderson screened this for him. "Quote unquote," he hit the roof at the movie's naked implication that L. Ron might have been making shit up as he went along.
No, I can see that.
Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
Executive producers get to exercise their voting fingers again this week with another prestige movie poll. This week's nominees are Mystic River, The Last Samurai, and Secondhand Lions. Take your pick and seal our fate.
This Monday on the Premium feed, we open up the books and deliver a State of the Empire podcast, talking about the current condition of Bald Move and our plans for this year.
This Friday, it's Lunch 420, which given last weekend seems like a tragic missed opportunity. Ah well. Lunch will be served piping hot at 1 p.m. Eastern. Come join live or warm up some leftovers when lunch is released in podcast form later that day.
If you want more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content plus ad-free feeds.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping.
Can we talk? I'm dying to talk about this in more detail. And some
do we want to get into the spoiler section?
I would love to, yeah, give a rundown of what the plot of this movie, basically, as it stands.
Okay.
And then we can get into specifics.
This movie is about Joaquin Phoenix, who plays Freddie Quell, who is a World War II naval veteran who has he might have brought some kind of kooky behavior into the Navy, but certainly the experiences that he's had killing people and surviving things have given him shell shock, what we call PTSD. He has a hard time adjusting to civilian life. We see him trying various jobs. He's got a passion and a talent for some artistic photography that doesn't, you know, leads him to getting some scuffles. He tries work as a migrant farm worker. He is an alcoholic of like one of the, I guess, of the basis sorts, the kind of guy that will drain a torpedo for its fuel and squeeze a few oranges in it. And it's monkey pump. It's monkey pump right out of the lighthouse.
Exactly. I have that in my notes too.
As a result of misadventures on Monkey Pump, he tries to flee by stowing away aboard a small cruise liner that turns out to have been commandeered by one Lancaster Dodd, who is L. Ron Hubbard by any name. He's played brilliantly by Seymour Hoffman. For some reason, Lancaster Dodd sees some kind of animal kinship in Joaquin Phoenix's Freddy. And that is like going to be his life's work to cure him, to awaken the sleeping animal into the thoughtful man that he knows everyone can behave. And the movie is a push pull loyalty, codependence, religious cult obsession between these two figures. Mm-hmm. And it goes surprising places. And it is
in a surprising place, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, it ends with what I think is supposed to be a happy ending.
Maybe. Maybe not. I don't know.
It's very open-ended. It's very open-ended. So there, if you haven't seen it, and I know a lot of people probably haven't, it is... I think it's got 85% of Rotten Tomatoes, but man, if you really dive into the individual reviews, there is some stark disagreement. There's a lot of confusion. Yeah. Everyone admits things. This is Paul Thomas Anderson's self-professed favorite movie.
Wow.
That he thinks he put the most into, that has the best performances. He says he doesn't think it entirely works, but he doesn't care because what he got on picture screen is kind of exactly what he wanted to do, and he wanted to tell the story. So you had something you were burning to get to. Right now we're going to be talking in in-depth spoilers. So if you think you want to see this movie, I don't think it's streaming for free anywhere, but again, I can definitely recommend Apple Plus has an amazing 4K transfer of this. What are you burning to talk about when it comes to the master?
Maybe we can keep on with, you know, Philip Seymour Hoffman's portrayal of not L. Ron Hubbard. I feel like the master is an ironic title in this movie because, you know, if you wanted to say that the master here that the title is describing is Lancaster Dodd, I think he is not the master of himself. And I think that's evident throughout the movie. There are several times where he has angry outbursts when someone challenges him. He is, in ways that I think we need to dive into here in a second, unfaithful to his wife.
Which wife? The one he's with now or the ones that are his biggest detractors and leading a movement to take him down?
Right. And then he even, I think, admits as much at the end of the movie when he's talking to Joaquin Phoenix out in London. He says, if you find a way to live without a master, let me know, because you'll be the first man to have ever done the first person to have ever done so.
Yeah.
So he is a slave to his own masters. He is not the master of himself. And I think that's the whole kind of point of this movie, right? If there is a point to it, I feel like that's it. That, like, everyone has their struggles with something, and you know, whether Scientology is the way to deal with that or not, this cause, I think is up in the air depending on what you think about it and who you are, but everyone struggles with finding a way to deal with that stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems like there's like, that's the kind of like megalomaniacal, but like fragility, because his whole shtick was, I've got a way to be in control mm-hmm. at all times and unlock this hidden potential that remains like the only, to be a fully awake human in the sea of slumbering beasts. But like, he can't quite live up to it.
Yeah.
He's faking it until he makes it, but he's faking being a nuclear physicist and a medical doctor. And I'm sorry, like I've seen Catch Me If You Can. That's something that's hard to kind of quote unquote get away with. Mm-hmm. So like these, and I think what the core fascination between him and Freddie is that he sees Freddie as this indomitable beast and like isn't capable of being cowed, does not recognize any master. Now it's to his detriment, but like,
well, I think that he does have a master. It's his vices, right? It's his, it's the monkey pump. It's his alcoholism is one of his masters.
Yeah. The fact that he is sex obsessed and in denial, deep denial about it as well.
And let me throw this out there because I did not tune into the wavelength of this movie, this wavelength at all until this second watch. And it was after the second watch, I had to go back and watch a couple of scenes again to tune into the homoerotic elements of this movie. Were you picking up on any of that?
I definitely thought the movie was, but I'm not a big fan of the homoerotic explanation for these men's behavior, because I just don't find it I don't find it extremely compelling textually.
I think there was
a mutual fascination and there is a physical intimacy, but like more like brothers than lovers.
I certainly agreed with you immediately after my second watch. I did not pick up any of that. And then I saw a review of somebody like it's surprising how many people and like respected film critics say the obvious homoerotic elements. And I'm like, are they obvious? Because I didn't see any. And I went back and I watched a couple scenes. So the scene that changed my mind on this, the two scenes, the pairing of them, is the scene where Philip Seymour Hoffman is singing and dancing and Joaquin Phoenix is watching him, and the room, all the women in the room become naked at some point.
This is the aroming.
I won't go aroming with you no more, that scene.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And then immediately after that, and if you watch that scene really closely, if you're not distracted by the naked ladies, Amy Adams, so Joaquin Phoenix is looking at Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Yeah.
And there's something going on in his head. And then Amy Adams is looking at him. Looking at Philip Seymour Hoffman. And immediately after that, there's a scene where Philip Seymour Hoffman gets a hand job from her. And she's saying, you can't do this. You can't get away with this. I don't care what you do, so long as I don't know about it. And I think it's pretty obvious at that point in the movie, at least, that there is a homoerotic flavor, at least coming from, well, I don't know why if she didn't think it was mutual, she would do anything here. But I feel like, that explains a little bit more. But I'm also with you. I don't think it's entirely just.
Oh, see, I think that's a fundamental misreading of that scene. I think the misreading of this, the plain reading of that scene, and if people want to read it homosexual, if people want to read a gay subtext to that scene, that's fine. I'm not offended by it, certainly. But what I think what's happening in that scene is, number one, Freddie is sex obsessed. Like halfway through the scene, he just starts seeing everyone with their clothes taken off because he's fascinated by that. Secondly, Lancaster Dodd is considering carnal relation with one, maybe two of the ladies in that room. And he is so drunk on the monkey pump that he is getting kind of sloppy in it. And she's looking at Freddie and him, and she's seeing the connection between Freddie's like wild animal desires and his monkey pump and the bizarre and the dangerous behavior of Philip Seymour Hoffman. And she gives him a hand job, number one, to cool his loins down, and two, remember, it's like, because she also brings up, like, you know, the biggest, your biggest attractors are all the ex-women in your life, and I'm based, and I'm like one of your co-authors and all this stuff, and you can't. So like,
she's not hostile toward any of the women in this movie. She's very hostile toward Freddie. And I, And because I don't think that is like leaning into the homoerotic nature of their relationship.
I think she is wrongly blaming Freddie for what seems to be a pattern in Philip Seymour Hoffman's life of acquiring these women followers and discarding them. But like, yeah, I mean, okay. Like I said, I'm not saying you can't read it, but like, I think because for one thing, if it's a homoerotic thing, it's a one sided because Freddie is crazy about women. Like there is no interest in men anywhere. Like they could have definitely put that in within the naval setting. Are you fucking kidding me? They could have definitely anchors away that for sure. And I don't think they did. Like he just seems like, you know, we get a lot of internal scenes from Freddie's perspective where he's just a girl crazy. And it doesn't seem like in an art of like, you know, like Brokeback Mountain where Jake Gyllenhaal and Heath Ledger were affecting that, you know, as like a way to like shield their underlying attraction towards each other. I didn't get that on this. Yeah.
No, it's genuine, but you know, it doesn't have to be mutual. You know, he could be obsessed with women, but also fall in love with this man. I don't think.
But I feel like that's lazy. It's the same way. It's like interpreting like Sam and Frodo as a gay couple. And if you want to do that, like in a somewhat ironic way, just as like, hey, it's gay representation. Fine. But like, I honestly think it does real harm to actual male relationships. Like that, like if men are close and they're physically close and they'll hug and like even like that, that's fucking gay. Like, holy shit. Sometimes I feel like we wrap around from homophobia so hard that we wind back up, you know, the opposite of crazy is still crazy. But
yeah,
again, I'm not going after
like them rolling around in the grass is homoerotic. I'm like, no, it's just roughhousing. That's
like I said, that's super brother type affection.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's but I like I said, I'm not mad. I just think it's a little wrong-headed.
I don't know, because then the song at the end, I think is super interesting. And it, you know, you could interpret that multiple ways also. You know, the Slow Boat to China song is
I wish I had you all to myself.
Certainly a song about romance or you know, sexual intimacy, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he's singing it directly to Freddie in this moment of finality in their relationship as Freddie's about to leave London. So you could read that as homoerotic, or you could read it as the challenge of it, right? It is what he's singing about here. I wish that for my life's work, I would have the opportunity to spend more time with you and truly fix you. There's that possibility too. And they're both potentially there.
Yeah, I don't know enough about Elrond's history to know if he was like maybe closeted gay, or I could definitely buy him being bisexual.
I have no idea.
But I felt like he was pretty notorious horn dog, and they definitely portray him in this movie as a philanderer. Mm-hmm. But like I said, he could be. I just felt like I saw that not criticism, but analysis, and I didn't. But of course, you went through and rewatched the scenes and recontextualized it, so.
I'm wrong too. Maybe, you know, it's not in there, but yeah, once someone points it out, you could see around the edges, there are definitely things, but that's the story of this movie in a nutshell is around the edges. Cause I don't feel like this movie ever directly gets to a point other than just a character study. I think it drops, you know, information every once in a while. It drops important clues, but I'm not actually sure what those clues add up to. Like, I haven't cracked the riddle of this movie. And it sounds like maybe Paul Thomas Anderson didn't crack the riddle of this movie either, based on what I read.
What do you think about the actual practices depicted here by the cause? Which again,
I think some of
you
them
know, this,
would
this,
be helpful and beneficial.
Well, this informal processing seems like it's very close to what Scientologists actually do in terms of auditing each other. These are like these psychological games, which are... Every one of these things are so fucking intense, man. Even the ones like that, when they start, it's kind of like a joke and they just ramp up till it's real to a point where like, you know, there's this one scene that I think is incredible where Joaquin Phoenix is going from a window to a wall until the sweat drops off his balls. He's going from the window to the wall and he's like, you know, trying to describe what it is. And first of all, he's trying to like be game. And then it's like, but he keeps on again. He's left in a room by himself and he's doing it to himself. And like, you know, Lancaster Dodd sitting watching him through a window, just raps like, I can't believe this shit. Like he can't believe this shit is happening. To where he's like, now he's like, he's torturing himself into like the episode of Star Trek: The Next Generation where Picard is forced to say there's three lights when there's actually four. Like, yeah. He talks about all the amazing vistas he can see out the window and how much he can feel the you know, like he's inverted to two places at one point. And he's literally there's another great scene where he's looking in Amy Adams' eyes and she says, "What a color are my eyes? Now imagine they're blue. Now imagine they're black." And it just shows that him changing his reality to match. They're brainwashing him in a real sense.
Yes. Those are the problematic elements of it. There are practices in this that I think would be effective and very helpful for somebody. And then there are practices which, you know, veer off radically into cult territory. And that blue eyes to black thing is 100% that. It's teaching you to ignore the truth of reality and believe what you're told to believe. That is the purpose of that exercise.
To trust an outside agency above your own faculties.
Yes. As is, you know, the walk to the window and the wall stuff. Now, I think earlier on, the informal processing stuff where you're getting to the root causes of people's trauma, I think that has a lot of value. I think that's more akin to traditional therapy as we think of it.
It's way more aggressive and invasive, but yeah.
Absolutely. And when you combine that with the fact that they are literally recording it, and what we know of Scientology is they use that to keep you in the cult, right? You've divulged a lot of things. It'd be a real shame if someone were to get their hands on this tape.
Only people that have audited their thetans will ever be able to understand that you did this and that and
Right. What will the public think? Yeah,
it becomes blackmail material.
That's where it becomes disgusting. But I think there are a lot of effective techniques early on in this movie.
Yeah, it's so also like
I'm torn on it.
I think L. Ron is an interesting figure because we just don't have that many religions founded that like have a shot at like, you know, within living memory. Like it's I don't know
Jedi's
how Scientology
to be around and
and like the Moonies and like the Heaven's Gate cult. Like we've definitely seen Hare Krishnas, we've seen things come and go, and there's you know, wax and wane, but like Scientology looks like it might make escape velocity. Like it might turn into and Alex is like, when I grew up in the Jehovah's Witnesses, we were at the tail end of the cult of personality. Like the last of the great presidents of the Watchtower Society, Raymond Friends, was an elderly man and he was going to die. And there would only be one more president before they moved away from that. And they just essentially had, these seven elder men that are going to all share leadership and first among equals, which kind of like, and then they kind of de-emphasize those men in the history. But like you go back and you think about like in the original days, like with Charles Taze Russell, or especially with like Judge Rutherford, some of those stories where it's like you're being a room for people joking around and then they get offended by something, just issue an edict. And it's clearly they're just personal opinion or knee jerk reaction to something. But we have to pretend like God just whispered something to our ear. Like there is a lot of that stuff. Or like there's classic stories of Judge Rutherford like a flop sweating right before he's supposed to give an international address, and he's promised that there's going to be some kind of banger new insight and teaching. He's like, Christ, oh my Christ, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, what am I going to say, oh my God, it's going to be over, they're going to know. And like, you obviously on the inside you never hear about those stories, but it's so interesting to see behind the other cults, like what that looks like, because I think that's it's also been said that like the best way to break a loved one out of a cult is get him to talking about an unrelated cult,
right?
You know,
and
like if you want
to draw some comparisons, not direct, but let them draw.
Yeah, just talk about, because like a Jehovah's Witness will readily see the crazy shit in Scientology and see it as science and see it as in nuts, and then if you can, without making direct comparison, just kind of like, you know, get them talking about like, ah, it's crazy. And they'll feel the cognitive dissonance themselves.
Yeah.
Or if you're trying to break someone out of the Scientology, you could talk about witnesses or some other, you know. And I think it's just so interesting to me for someone that's from that background to see this like dramatized and see that. Like, I would love a Founding Jehovah's Witness movie. Oh, my God.
Yes.
I would love a 3.5 hour exploration of like the dirty tricks that went, you know, that, that, you know, it's like, because we have our own Joseph Smith died and Brigham Young slew all, you know, pretenders to dethrone and took things over. And
to even just see like crisis of conscience made into a movie, because the
shakedown in the late 70s, early 80s, where there's a high profile. The brother of that Raymond Friends. Was it his brother or nephew? But he was on the governing body and he turned defector. And became like this, just through the whole,
you know, some bad shit that he saw happening in like Mexico, I think it was, or South America. I can't remember.
Yeah. It was the idea that, the brothers made a decision that like, well, like I guess 5 years ago there's like some bloodshed in Rwanda where the brothers said, hey, anyone that didn't have the political card that identified them with the ruling party were summarily executed in places. And there's just terrible tales of the brothers and sisters in that country being tortured in like Rwanda, Malawi. And then 5 years later in Mexico, there was an exact similar situation where the brothers needed to procure a political party card to gain employment and stuff. And it's not even, it wasn't as bad. Like some, the brothers from Africa be butchered and having their fucking dicks hooked up to car batteries and shit. It was just kind of like a bummer. Like it's harder to find work in Mexico. And like 5 years later, it's like, oh yeah, you can buy that card. Mm-hmm. And like that, like, he's like,
all the people who suffered in the meantime. Yeah. An arbitrary decision. What's an obviously
And half of these old men are falling asleep during the meetings where they're discussing whether you should do this or that. And it's like, he's like, this is just fucking arbitrary and people are dying. So like,
get Jared Harris, who wrote Chernobyl? What's his name?
Oh, yeah. Craig Mazin.
Craig Mazin and Jared Harris on that project. I will 100% be there day one.
Yeah, yeah. You can call it the Bible students if you want to dodge the Jehovah's Witness thing.
Sure. But yeah, I think this movie is pretty good about being that without like being overtly that. I don't know.
Yeah, and it's like one of those things that to the extent to all cults, because like they have the same, like they love bomb you at the beginning. And that's like, so that's what's, if you think that you're too smart to fall for a cult, you're not wrong. You're probably at more risk. If you think that you, you know, the only defense of cults, I think, is to have a well-developed sense of self and have tons of people in your life that love and support you unconditionally.
Yeah, an already that's existing social network, yep.
That's the best way to inoculate yourself from cult shit. But like what where they take this fundamentally damaged person that feels like he's just uniquely evil, probably because of his sex, you know, his obsession with sex, all the people he'd killed. And you're going to sit there and he feels like he's worthless and no one sees him. And you, a great man, are going to singularly focus and say that you are this and you are that. And I'm going to pay attention. I'm going to ask questions that might be offensive, but like no one's ever asked these questions or no one's even gave a shit. And then simultaneously, once you do that, the shame and fear of losing that, you finally found this connection, this acceptance, and it can be withdrawn in a snap of the fingers. And you are so terrified of that happening. That scene of Laura Dern, where she's like, I'm sorry, I've read the second book and you were very specific that the verbiage and auditing was supposed to be this. And you've gone from it is observed to we can imagine. And what? And the reality is Lancaster Dodd has no fucking clue.
All right.
He's just making his ship as he goes along. And he tries to give like he gives a pretty well thought out answer. But she doesn't accept it because she's a true devout. She wants to understand this, you know. And she's essentially getting the William Shatner SNL treatment where he just like, get a fucking life. Like, what the fuck is your problem? This is the new shit. And just shuts her down. Like, that felt really real. And you see the look on her face like, oh, my God. Like, she's the warring of like, is like the cognitive dissonance in a 1984 sense of holding two contradictory ideas in her head of, is this bullshit? Am I wrong? Can I question Lancaster Dodd? And what is like, it's just all right there in her face. And I think it's fucking brilliant.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And there's nothing that extreme, you know, in the witness organization, right? You're not forced to walk between a wall and a window for hours at a time until
there is weird stuff though. Because I'm thinking about, like, as like I don't want to tell stories out of school, but my sister had some problems walking the narrow line. And I guess, like, when you get the, when they have the judicial committees, mm-hmm. where they, the older men in the congregation convene a group of three of them to get to the bottom of a matter involving wrongdoing and witnesses. If this already mm-hmm. sounds culty as fuck, it is.
Yeah, I've been through one of these. Sure.
I guess these old men sometimes get these teenage girls and to a lesser extent boys in those back rooms and just go into graphic detail of like, oh, how many fingers did he put inside you? Did you have an orgasm? Mm-hmm. How many orgasms were, did you get? Were you aroused? Were you wet? Did he like,
are what you aroused? Are you a wet what old man? Because
yeah, what? Oh no, I think they're like fucking Freddy on the beach, man. Like it's right. really uncomfortable, and I think that I always like anytime I want to say, well, the witnesses aren't extreme. It's like yeah, but like there's other things.
No, from
like,
an indoctrination perspective, that's what yes. I'm talking about here. The love bombing absolutely happens.
Yeah,
the indoctrination beyond that is a lot more subtle, I think. Than portrayed,
but still
in this
thousands
movie.
Of witnesses die a year because they won't take blood.
Very effective. Oh,
I yeah. don't know how many Scientologists die worldwide. If you want to rule out Linda Miscavige, I don't know how many Scientologists die worldwide because of their beliefs. I know that thousands and the witnesses still do. So, mm-hmm. like, which is worse? Which is more extreme? How many families have they destroyed? Sure. How many sure. careers, economic futures? You know, if you want to, like, a lot. There's quite a toll, I think, on both organizations. But that's the stuff
I think
liked.
It's more effective, though. I mean, the witnesses are a bigger organization than Scientology. Yeah. And I think that's partially due to the fact that their methods are more subtle, just as effective, but more subtle. And their teachings on the face of it are not as batshit insane.
Well, yeah, there's some batshit. I mean, like witnesses are old school Aryan heretics, but like, yeah, they
We're
still profess
that,
belief in Jesus
insane.
Christ. And yeah, that kind of,
I mean,
yeah.
Yeah. As long as you talk about Jesus and God, I think you get a level of like immediate respect and like recognition. Okay. Yeah. This is something that isn't totally outside my sphere of knowledge. But once you start talking about Xenu and shit, you right. lost everyone.
But I don't know, because like, are the Scientologists uniquely extreme, or are they just in their Judge Rutherford phase? Because they had their Charles Taze Russell. He died. Sure, this sure. ruthless kind of fucker took over. How many times when he dies, how many times can that happen before the struggle for power weakens everybody to where there's some kind of, and like there's going to be increasing pressure? To the extent that the Scientology continues to be defiant, continues to like confine people against their will, and people die under mysterious circumstances, and they go to war with the IRS and shit like that. Like, you can't keep doing that. Mm-hmm. You'll eventually have to be moderated or destroyed. So, like, give, you know, witnesses have been kicking around for 150, 170 years.
Sure, but at this point, I mean, they are far less extreme in their methods. Certainly, maybe this is growing pains. Maybe this is, you know, because they're a newer organization, but...
Yeah, they'll eventually. I have no idea how they'll either mellow out or they'll probably be destroyed or confirmed to consigned to irrelevancy. Mm-hmm. I got a question. Did this movie kill Philip Seymour Hoffman? He had 12 years of sobriety coming into this movie. In 2012, mm-hmm. just after it got made, he fell off the wagon and was dead a year later.
Huh.
And
he died soon after, but I didn't realize
this.
That he
I've never seen anyone make an explicit connection, but when I was watching this material, knowing that he dies mm-hmm. shortly later, I'm thinking the intensity of this, the amount of like fucking drinking that they had to at least pretend to do. And the mental state that like they have to pretend to be like psychotic alcoholics, like that can't be healthy. That couldn't have been healthy for him.
No, certainly not. That's a hard thing, I would think. I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't take all the credit if I were PTA, but certainly it probably contributed.
Do you think that the Scientologists put Tom Cruise through this shit? Does he have to go through auditing? Because I know that the celebrity branch of Scientology is quite a bit different from the rank and file. Mm-hmm. But do you think like David Miscavige gets into Tom Cruise's face and asks if he's ever had sex with a family member 17 times in a row? And because like and
probably like I imagine. Yeah.
And which do you think Tom Cruise found more bizarre, that or Stanley Kubrick's putting him through the ringer on Eyes Wide Shut?
I don't remember that exact story. I know that was a traumatic experience for both of them.
There is a Hollywood theory that Stanley Kubrick made that movie just to get to the chewy caramel center of Tom Cruise. Is he a real person? Is their marriage a sham? I don't know. Which is more stressful, being audited or being an Eyes Wide Shut?
To make a movie with it was his ex-wife at the time. Was Nicole Kidman?
No, they were married. Divorced?
They were still married.
Not yet. I don't even know if that movie broke them. They got broke soon after. Yeah.
I don't know. I imagine he does go through this stuff. I imagine that everyone at some point goes through this, and maybe there are less intense versions of it. Maybe there are versions where it's just exploratory to find the dirt, and we're going to make it easy for them so that we can find that dirt, especially if they're a millionaire who we want their cash. But yeah, I mean, that's the whole point. Well, it's not the whole point. There are several points to this, but one of the points of this processing or this interrogation technique is to find that dirt, right? So however they can do it, especially on someone who's got a lot to lose, the more you have to lose, I feel like the better that interrogation and blackmail material works out for you.
What's your favorite scene? What's your favorite set piece in this movie?
My absolute favorite scene is that first informal processing scene where Joaquin Phoenix is not allowed to blink. I think there's something, I have a weird morbid fascination with actors experiencing physical trauma during performances.
Yeah.
And it's why I love the Willem Dafoe getting buried alive in the lighthouse. I think that's an amazing performance. And it's why I love that 24-hour live stream of the third day where Jude Law digs his own grave for like 2 hours.
Like, if you want to win a Jim Oscar, just get buried alive on camera, and it's a shoe-in. It's shoe-in.
Do something that is physically grueling while delivering one of the most amazing performances I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And I'll fall in love with that scene because that is my favorite scene from this movie.
I think mine is when Lancaster Dodd and Freddie get arrested. Lancaster Dodd is being arrested because he's stolen all of Widow's money, and now she feels a certain way about it. And they're in jail, and Joaquin Phoenix is using he's handcuffed on his back, and he is using his body as a battering ram to destroy this jail cell. As Philip Seymour Hoffman is in the cell over, just looking at him, and he's just like destroys this toilet. There's this like Murphy's bed on chains that he's just like fucking, like, I don't know how he didn't get a concussion. I'm sure maybe that was all purpose built out of foam or something, but it looks and sounds so real, and it goes on forever, and the movie just and then Lancaster Dodd starts in with his Lancaster Dodd bullshit, and Freddie is so worked up he's not having it, and just turns into like a fuck you, fuck me, fuck you, fuck you, fuck me.
Yeah,
that just keeps oh God, it's like I can't rip my eyes off of it. It's just so crazy. And this movie's got 6 scenes like that.
Right. No, physically it's an insane scene for Joaquin Phoenix. And I think, you know, what it's saying about these two people in the moment is equally as impressive, because like you said, Philip Seymour Hoffman's standing there just watching him, and he's as calm, cool, and composed as he's ever been, right? And this beast is over in the other cell thrashing around, destroying everything with his base disgusting behavior. And then Philip Seymour Hoffman cracks. And I think that's like saying so much about his character, where this is a facade. This is a struggle for him. It's not something that he's unlocked a secret of a universe and suddenly, you know, his previous lifetimes are affording him some grace and composure. It's just, he's white knuckling every second of it, right?
Yeah, there's a couple scenes where I just got to wonder, why does Lancaster Dodd, because you're talking about him white knuckling. There's a scene where he's passing out Scientology literature, offering free audits and stuff. And you're, like I said, white knuckling. Like, you're just like the whole time you're watching, like, who's he going to punch? Oh my God, who's he going to punch? Because that guy, oh my God, that guy just wadded up and threw it in front of it. And he's like paused, like he's about to eat the man. Like, why did Lancaster Dodd put him in those positions? Was it to provoke him? Was it to put faith in him? Was it just to see what the fuck would happen?
It's a really good question. It might be all of those. Because you have to remember also, this is a big experiment for Lancaster as well, right? Like, Freddy is his subject, his guinea pig, and he is trying to work out his teachings real time on the fly through this man. Because he's only written one book at this point. He's written The Cause, and his second book, The Split Saber, will come out at some point during this movie, but he's still feeling his way through it. So yeah, I think it's all of that. I think, like, if he breaks Freddy, he'll have learned something. If Freddy comes through it, you know, a better person, a changed man, he'll have learned something. And I don't think either of those outcomes are particularly bad. And I think maybe that changes by the end of the movie. Because there is some kind of genuine love there, not necessarily homoerotic, just love between these two men. But yeah, it's an experiment. Throw them in the fire. See what happens.
You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info. We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
All What part of making Joaquin Phoenix put on an ill-fitting suit clinic is a part of that experiment?
Which scene is this? Every scene?
This thing is every once in a while he shows up looking dapper, like, because that's the thing is, like, this guy does have this
functions with
this guy does have the Freddie is displayed as having like a raw charisma that people find likable.
Sure.
It's just like he's got the opposite of most people's problems where it's like we you know, like, we're too embarrassed or shy to talk to people. He like just goes in and like people like him. But then you can see where like people are like, oh, God, this is a bit too much. You know, it's like when he throws himself on the sandcastle maiden and starts fucking it, like all the guys are like laughing like that's hilarious. But then he just keeps going and going and going. And like you can see the guys like, OK. And then everyone's like, this is fucking weird and uncomfortable. There's tons of scenes like that where like he takes a part where like everyone is liking him and he just ruins it. I don't know if it's because he has to or because that's just his social damage, but I don't know, the ill-fitting suit. I just like got a real kick out of how weirdly gangly Joaquin Phoenix has gotten. You see this also in the Joker performance he put on, but just like, and how that is accentuated or completely hidden by good or bad tailoring.
Yeah, I think he's got like some shoulder blade stuff, some back stuff going on.
Does he, or is that all a performance? Because man, I remember that scene in the Joker where he like, I don't know, thought wings were going to shoot out of his back or something.
I remember we talked about this. Yeah, at that point, maybe a couple other times, but yeah, I think he has some physical deformity. I don't know if it's a result of a birth defect or an accident or something. I couldn't tell you, but there's something definitely unnatural about his back, which whatever it he leans into that sometimes in his performances and it really works
for a lot of this movie. His face is so hard and cruel too. It's like like twisted into a permanent sneer, like
even when he's smiling there's like something sinister. Like when he's genuinely smiling there still comes off as like an energy that's
unsettling, because this could go crazy places at any time.
We haven't really talked much about Freddie as a character. Like what is his damage? I know obviously like he comes back from the war and he's seen some shit, he's done some shit, and that's turned him into a damaged person, but I get the impression based on what he was talking about with his family that there was something before that too. Like his mother ended up in a mental facility, his father died of alcoholism
essentially.
I think so. Drank himself to death. And I think he took that with him into the war. I don't think he was just this happy-go-lucky kid when he went into World War II.
I mean, if you know anything about the Pacific Front, of course, he wasn't a Marine. He was a sailor, but still, holy shit, the amount of death and depravity that those guys saw serving in the Pacific Front was legendary.
Yeah.
So like, it's like he went in probably fucked up and came out fucked up plus shell-shocked.
Yeah, I think so. And man, the levels that he sinks to in this movie are incredible in the early goings.
But there's also some acts of like, I don't want to say heroism, but like the way it portrays in the movie, his ghosting that 16-year-old girl was a noble thing. Mm-hmm. Like he could have had her. She was all set to leave her entire life and go off with him. And he just knew at some level it was wrong.
And
she was too young, and then went off and did these crazy thing. And then came back later when, you know, she was like 24, 25. But of course, it's too late. He's been gone for almost 10 years and she's shacked up with another guy and married.
There are good choices and mistakes that are made in that scenario.
But it's like there's a weird energy that runs through a lot of Paul Thomas. I didn't notice for the first time until I watched Licorice Pizza, which I've talked about a few times, made me uncomfortable. And there you have a relationship between the Haim lady, who I think is playing her mid-20s, maybe even late 20s in this movie. She's real life in her 30s, and a 15-year-old boy that ends with the happy ending of them getting together in like a boyfriend-girlfriend way at the end. This movie about Joaquin Phoenix, damaged Joaquin Phoenix, only girl for him being a 16-year-old. I think in Boogie Nights, Marky Mark starts as an underage kid to get sucked into porn. Is Paul Thomas Anderson hiding a lot of sexual darkness that is like leaking out in his material? Because like this seems to be a recurring theme, the corruption of youth. And sure. Like in this movie, I think it's seen as a good thing that the guy like, you know, but like, man, there's a I think a plain reading of Licorice Pizza that's like, well, what if Lolita, but it's a guy, it's a boy and it's cool. That I found very uncomfortable as a you know, I'm saying like if what's her name? Is it Alana? Hannah Haim comes to my fucking house after my 15-year-old boy, I'm loading a shotgun, you know, like that's fucked up. But I don't think that movie knows that. Did you get like, really? what was your kind of take on
that? I haven't seen Licorice Pizza. But in this movie, there are, let's say, more correct decisions made. It's a man who sees himself falling into a bad situation with a young girl, and I decides to take himself out of the equation for a while.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, same.
And go off to war. Go, just take odd jobs, whatever he's doing during that time. And then by the time he is free to return, and she would have been old enough, he's such a damaged person that he is too ashamed or something. I think it's shame. Too ashamed of his behavior to return to her. And when he finally gets some semblance of a grasp on his life, it's now too late to be with her.
I think they so got married. My takeaway for the second time watching this is that it was part and parcel. Because he ran off from the master on that sweet ass old Norton commando on Salt Flats, went to her hometown, found that. Uh-huh. I think that was his being like, you know what? Before I met this guy, I made a man decision that was not animal. It was for it was for someone else's benefit, and I did it without the cause. And I actually can trust myself to make good sober decisions.
Now that he's sober, yeah.
And then he took that into that strength, that conviction that like I don't need this. Led him to get away from the extremely high pressure sales tactic that the master used at the end of the movie and gets to some. I mean, I think the end of the story is like him finding some kind of equilibrium. I don't know if he'll like he still needs a fucking therapy and probably some lithium, but like it's a hopeful ending of the movie. He's with a woman of his own age. That he is connecting with her like on a human basis and like with a little bit of humor, using like auditing techniques that he thinks is a joke.
Well, and he's taking the techniques that I deem as valuable, at least in some regard, and using those. Honesty. He's not having her walk to the window on the wall over and over or tell him that his eyes are green when they're actually brown, you know?
Right.
I think you're right. There's a hopeful note at the end of this. Because he doesn't seem to be drunk at that point either, right? Like he goes to a bar and he picks up this woman, and those are the behaviors that before would have led him spiraling down.
Right.
And in this scene, it doesn't feel like a spiral.
Yeah, we saw other times where he entered relationships and women and they went bad almost immediately. He started like this. It seems like they're telling a different tale.
For sure.
I thought that was the core.
He goes to... what's her name? Doris's house.
Doris, yeah.
And it meets with her mother. She tells him that she's been married for 3 years and she lives in Arkansas or something. And he doesn't immediately try to go there and blow that up so that he can have her, right? He makes a decision that's good for her in that moment, not for him. And another one. So, yeah, I think like...
And I'm not saying he navigated that talk with her mother perfectly because he's still a deeply weird guy. But he did like what I would say is the moral thing in every point in a conversation. Do you want me to tell her? There's no point in that. It would only cause pain. Yeah. If she's happy, then I'm happy for her and that's good enough for me.
Yeah. And this is all happening after he's had his experience with the cause, right?
Right. He's left of us like he was ready. Yeah. Another question. When it comes to mind fucking manipulative, dominating hand jobs. You go with Anna Gunn, or you're going with Amy Adams.
Nothing against Anna Gunn, but I'll take the Amy Adams hand job all day long. All day long.
She starts a movement called The Jerk. I gotta say, mm-hmm. might want to read that newsletter. There might be something to that. There might be something to that technique.
I got a question for you. What the hell does his son think of all this? Because he's one of the craziest characters in this entire movie for me, because he knows that it's all bullshit. He says as much during this movie, and yet he follows him to the ends of the earth, to London, to another country, to participate and be part of this school. What is his deal?
So the real answer is, I think he's an exact analog to L. Ron Hubbard Jr., L. Ron's real son that had a very conflicted relationship with his dad. And I think that, like, he's caught, but he knows this is bullshit. But if he doesn't go along with it, his dad's just a kind of loser, minor science fiction writer. Like, so they're not going to be
your own life, man. Why are you following?
With what money? He's cruising the world with his dad with,
job.
He's clearly not happy. Like, I'm just saying that's what he's doing. I don't think it's the good thing. Yeah, it's not aspirational. No. It's just, and the other, like, the hang, like, I thought the same thing about Rami Malek.
Father's life. You're not living.
This is a guy who's terrified of being cut off from the royal family. In fact, I thought that whole scene of everybody going and trying to assassinate Freddie's character is just a bunch of paranoid lunatics that know the only thing they got going on in life is their connection as other paranoid lunatic. And as Freddie's power and connection grow with Lancaster Dodd, theirs wanes.
Yeah.
And like that felt very realistic of like these internal power struggles between the different. And my question is, like, did Lancaster Dodd understand when these things were going on that these are people who are just trying to protect their power and influence with him and over him, and he's taking them at good faith, or does he know that they're full of shit, or does he just not consider himself bound by anything, so he can just dismiss their claims the way he does in this movie?
Sure, in the gentlest way possible, with a thank you.
Mm-hmm. But I'm still going to do the thing that I wanted to do.
I think it's the latter. I think he feels like he is the only agent in this equation. And he's going to do what he wants to do, even though he doesn't want to disrespect the people who follow him. And I think, you know, there's a cynical side to that. Like, he realizes it's important not to piss these people off too much because he wants followers. But they're also, I think he, in some respects, does value their opinion. I think, like, there's a push and pull here between him and his wife when it comes to Freddie. His wife is very much against Freddie, you know, for her own reasons or not, but
because they're gay lovers,
some credence to that feeling. I don't think he dismisses it out of hand.
Yeah.
He simply is drawn to this man more than he is willing to acquiesce to his wife's demands.
He's a person that has to be brought over to the side. And then, now that I'm thinking about it more, I think there is an arc to this movie. It's kind of buried because there's the second book. There's the shattered saber, the split saber. Mm-hmm. And there's this scene where you're seeing 60 seconds of the Elrond guy reading out of his follow up to Dianetics, essentially. Yeah. And you get to where it's close up on Freddy listening. And essentially the revelation is that we should laugh more, and the pure source energy actually comes from you.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, like, he goes through all the processes of grief, where at first it's denial. It's like, there's nothing positive, pure coming from me. The anger, where he talks to his editor and beats him up because he's expressing doubt. Then he goes and steals the guy's motorcycle and goes off. Like, I think that Elrond fucked up by making it up, saying like, oh, everything good comes from you. And he thinks, you know what? A few times I've made decisions that were for better. Maybe I am connected to some kind of pure source energy. Maybe good things can come from me, and winds up decultifying himself.
Yeah, I think you're right. Let me ask you this. Why do you think he goes to London? Because he's already had these experiences. Is this,
I think
is
he
this
wanted
a chance
to
say goodbye? Is this a chance?
It's a chance to say goodbye and a chance to maybe see if they could have a relationship outside of bending the knee. Because Elrond says, like, you, Amy Adams says, this is a billionaire commitment or not at all. He's like, you either fully commit to the cause or you get the fuck out. Well, what about in the next room?
You're dead to me. Yeah.
What about a next lifetime? And then, like, and then once he knows that it's over and there's no other way to, because I think he does love him like a brother at this point and owes him a lot.
But he doesn't love the man enough to live a life that's ruled by the man.
Because he doesn't want a master.
Ultimately. Yeah. Yeah, which is kind of the whole teaching. You know, he taught him. He effectively kicked him out of the church or the organization, the movement, whatever, the cause, by teaching him too well, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah, making him too mentally, or then it's a process of like showing his own weaknesses and also building up Freddy to a point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah, it's an interesting film, man. I don't know if it's my favorite PTA film, but it's up there. It's definitely up there. I guess There Will Be Blood's got to be my favorite.
Yeah, I mean, without a doubt, There Will Be Blood, I think, is his masterpiece. I'm not sure what PTA sees in this movie that makes it his favorite of his films. I know he had a looser approach to this movie than most of his other films. He just sort of combined elements that he thought were intriguing or interesting, or characters that he thought were interesting, and didn't so much force the outcome of it into a very, like, you know, neat bow. And I think that shows in the movie. And I think that is reflected by all of the reviews that are like, I don't get this movie. Or saying it's amazing because of what an enigma it is. Yeah, I think that's the product of the way that he made this movie, for sure.
Yeah. No, I think he, I also read in the making of that he had been working on this movie for 12 years and he just kept on adding, like, oh, I got this experience of this great older actor who was in World War II, and he talked about all these different naval hijinks, and I'm going to add that to it. And there's these couple of like these brutal, psychologically scarring scenes and There Will Be Blood that I couldn't fit into the movie, but I could adapt into this. And I read this interesting thing about the early Scientology, and he just kept on like adding, and it, like, it's this thing that like, deep, it also seemed like it was born out of his work. Like every new thing that he did movie wise he was able to bring a little bit of, and this is kind of like his synthesis of all the experiences that he's had as a creator, and putting them in that. So it's like, I feel like it's deeply personal in that way, that it felt that like, you know, he collected pieces of himself and put this into his movie, and then there you go.
Can I say, I think they could not have cast a better son of Philip Seymour Hoffman than Jesse Plemons. I think he actually does look a ton like Philip Seymour Hoffman.
It's amazing. Yeah, it's really good. And I even thought just the daughter like looks like a very conceivable Amy Adams Philip Seymour Hoffman. Yeah,
absolutely. The one final thing I wanted to talk about briefly, because it's just a thing I found interesting, is the way that Philip Seymour Hoffman's surroundings when he goes to London match his inflated ego. Boy, and I get the impression that Philip Seymour Hoffman at that point is running from his reputation in America, and he has moved
to
London.
He's overstayed his welcome.
Yeah, very much so. But when Freddie walks into his office at this school, his office is essentially the size of a gymnasium. And it has extraordinary windows behind him. And he's sitting at a desk in this largely empty room. And it's this massive desk with massive chair behind him. And the grandiosity of it all, but the emptiness of that room really left me with like a hollow feeling. A feeling on the man that left me thinking it was more image than it was true belief in his teachings.
I had the same feeling that you came in here and that he's got this big campus, everything was bigger and better, but like it's also Like every level of fraud and entails a going something bigger and bolder, but also a little bit hollower and a little bit more edifice and a little bit more fake.
The image is growing, but the following is not, sort of feeling.
And I don't know how, honestly, it seems like a touch and go thing about Scientology surviving his death, because, like, you know, at his height, like, they had this big, like, fleet of vessels and they were traveling around the world, and then he dies, and by the 80s, like, their Sea Org had retired to land-based bases all over the, and like, you know, there had to be a struggle for power amongst his top acolytes. I that might be fascinating. Like I said, I'd much rather them do a Bible student picture. I think I'd be more in for that. But that must be a fascinating time, because, like, how do you successfully navigate a cult of personality when the personality dies? And there's no, like, you know, it's like one thing if you have successors, children and whatnot, that are, you know, the Billy Graham Juniors and whatnot. But, like, yeah, this case where what do you do when your kids are kind of hate you? I guess you get a Miscavige. So,
yep.
Anything That's else? It. Yeah, no. This is interesting, because, like, we started doing Bald Movies a year or two after. This is, like, in the Bald Move era. But, like, before we're doing movies, and I think that these 10-year anniversaries will give us a nice chance to go back and fill in, you know, these, like, because, like, once we get caught up to, like, 2013, 2014 or so, it's like we'll probably have covered the majority of the movies we'd want to. But there's a lot of gems. There's a lot of gems in this 3-4 year interim period. So we'll probably continue to explore them. But yeah, happy 10th anniversary to this weird film that I feel deeply connected to. It is, I think, fascinating to watch. It's not for everybody. Not everybody's going to get it. But if you're a Paul Thomas Anderson fan, I can't imagine wanting to skip this, because it's his personal favorite. It's fascinating from that perspective alone. Anyway, yeah, congratulations to making it 10 years in the pop culture imagination. I really enjoyed revisiting it. We will be back with another prestige television show or movie real soon. And until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.